The History of Magic, Volume 1, by Joseph Ennemoser, read by Graham Dunlop. Editor's Preface. Of the nature and character of a work like the following, nothing need be said. It is enough that, at a moment when the public mind occupies itself with the class of subjects on which it treats, the researches of an earnest and indefatigable student cannot be unimportant, even though the reader may not always arrive at the same conclusions that he has done. To those curious in literary history, it may not be uninteresting to know that this translation occupied my husband and our eldest son during their voyage to Australia in 1852. And perhaps the dream of prevision mentioned at page 416 of the appendix may be explained in part by the mind of the translator being occupied at the time by the peculiar views of Ennemoser, which predisposed it for occult impressions. This explanation, it appears to me, is rendered still more probable by another little circumstance, which being no way irrelevant to the subject I will mention. The printing of this Ennemoser translation had commenced, and to a certain extent my mind was imbued with the views and speculations of the author. When, on the night of the 12th of March, 1853, I dreamed that I had received a letter from my eldest son. In my dream, I eagerly broke open the seal and saw a closely written sheet of paper, but my eye caught only these words in the middle of the first page, written larger than the rest and underdrawn: "My father is very ill." The utmost distress seized me, and I suddenly awoke, to find it only a dream. Yet the painful impression of reality was so vivid that it was long before I could compose myself. The first thing I did the following morning was to commence a letter to my husband relating this distressing dream. 6 days afterwards, on the 18th, an Australian mail came in and brought me a letter, the only letter I received by that mail, and not from any of my family, but from a gentleman in Australia with whom we were acquainted. This letter was addressed on the outside, "Immediate." And with a trembling hand, I opened it. And true enough, the first words I saw, and these written larger than the rest in the middle of the paper, and underdrawn, were, "Mr. Howitt is very ill." The context of these terrible words was, however, "If you hear that Mr. Howitt is very ill, let this assure you that he is better." But the only emphatic words were those which I saw in my dream, and these, nevertheless, slightly varying as from some cause or other, all such mental impressions, spirit revelations, or occult dark sayings generally do, from the truth or type which they seem to reflect. Thus it appears to me that while we cannot deny the extraordinary psychological phenomena which are familiar to the experience of every human being, they are yet capable of a certain explanation wherever we are enabled to arrive at the circumstances which render the mind receptive of such impressions. The susceptibility either of individuals or bodies of people to these influences seems to presuppose an abnormal condition. In the appendix will be found some curious matter, derived in many cases from old and almost forgotten sources, and given for the most part in the words of the original authors. M.H., London, May 1854. Author's Preface. As it is customary for everyone on going into foreign countries to take a passport in order to ensure his unimpeded progress, in like manner it has also been the usage, from time immemorial, for books to carry before them such a document of legitimacy, in order to ensure for themselves a favorable reception. This book requires all the more such preliminary authentication, as its very name has something suspicious about it, and its contents are amongst the things which are generally considered contraband, and are often subjected to confiscation, or even, as blasphemies, to the tender mercies of the Inquisition. Different readers will look at this book from very different points of view. By some, it will be esteemed only as a curiosity. Others will find matter for further research. One will wish to learn magic arts from it, and another will draw from it philosophical conclusions. All will be welcome, and will find, I believe, if not instruction, at least amusement and ample food for reflection. for it treats of remarkable phenomena and uncommon effects, which have certainly hitherto been looked upon as mere phantoms, or as belonging to a sphere quite unconnected with nature, but which nevertheless are a portion of history, and surely on that account are of universal interest. Magnetism, by its remarkable phenomena in modern times, has led us into a sphere which still, like a closed book, contains secrets of a higher order of things, lying beyond the familiar, everyday history of nature. Before the discovery of magnetism, it was believed that science had already exhausted the world, and that the human mind had noted down on the map of natural and inner life everything that could and could not exist in heaven and earth. Magnetism itself stood in the background. It was looked upon as something that is nothing and cannot exist. Such obsolete, dusty charts are still often found hanging over the desks of zealous champions who, in knightly manner, fight boldly against deceit and destruction for the beautiful prepared possession. Now, however, magnetism, not content with its manifold wonders, leads the way back into the mysterious domain of exploded magic, gathers up old tales and long-forgotten laws of mysterious action from a transcendental world, which estimates on one hand the present standard of science as valueless, and on the other orthodox dogmas as the work of the devil. Whilst the former thus fears to be led back into the gloom of the mystical twilight of the past by such attempts as are described in this book, where only the phantasms of faith in miracles play their wild game, the latter resists boldly in the anxious fear lest all miracles should cease to be miraculous. Thus, if it should appear that the author's intention had been only to ridicule the understanding and wisdom of the times, collecting merely show and glitter instead of materials for true science, or to disturb the comfortable peace of pious minds by seeking to vulgarize the sacred and to degrade the divine, or even to open the door to atheism, it is the more necessary to give the reader some preparatory notion of the construction and tendency of this work, which is probably still a stranger to most of them. Whilst many of our contemporaries, unused to or incapable of deep reflection, feel no desire or impulse to pursue serious researches on the singular phenomena of nature and the action of the soul, there are others who perceive or even comprehend the most hidden springs of mysterious action, but will not place these on the theater of earthly commonplace, fearing the desecration of the impious world. The latter fear, not without cause, only to advance human vanity and to open to mankind a perspective of the most exalted truths, for which as yet but few are prepared. There are also false critics who, like false prophets, rather accuse the whole former world of folly and deceit than confess that they do not know how to grapple with undeniable facts, and who with their own statutes and foolish imaginations fall far short of the prudent simplicity of old, which taught harmony and a regular correspondence between the visible and the invisible world, which is truly little acknowledged, because besides the clear brilliancy of the outward eye, it requires a certain unction of the inner. Whilst the mere stoichia tu cosmu do not contain the substance and origin of things. The contents of this book are, without reference to the above-mentioned contradictory motives, entirely occupied with those mesmeric appearances, which formerly were called magical and now magnetic. In the present state of opinion, therefore, it cannot, of course, aspire to universal approbation. It may, however, if it does not interest, at least not be generally displeasing, as the author seeks everywhere with complete impartiality only the historical traces of true facts and the phenomena connected with them, compares these and endeavors to lead them back to certain laws of nature, which in truth may be considered as something more than mere polluted pools or decayed pillars. If some things which are discussed do not always bear the impress of infallible truth, or even if some principles on which they are based be not the firmest, still it cannot easily be said that they are invented or that it is all a deception. Even if they were really true, of which indeed we have many proofs, we may here and there find occasion to give them more consideration and to test the utility of their application in order perhaps to succeed in discovering constant forces, even in the midst of more infrequent actions, in clearing away many difficulties which general science does not solve, and in opening a wider field of operations for human activity, so that it may attain at last the exalted end of spiritual destiny. As such, at least, is the aim of this novice sent among strangers, that hopes to meet, if not with protection and shelter, at least with a fair hearing. This book appeared, indeed, about 20 years ago, but in another garb, and then bore, contrary to the desire of its author, a somewhat unsuitable title. It was headed by the suspicious word scientific. At that time, the clerks and general controllers of all knowledge, lying in wait at all corners and paths, seized hold of the unpolished stranger with merciless severity, declared his passport forged, found not a single good point about him, and asserted that he had nothing but damaged or contraband goods. A few, however, secretly searched his pockets, dishonestly abstracting therefrom various things, to be brought to market secretly as their own property. In spite of all, the bookseller found his profit in it, and ere long the edition was sold out. All at once the novice reappears at a time, but in quite a different form, with less pretension outwardly, but inwardly much more richly endowed. With a certain independence and confidence, he now steps forward in a more solid form, little heeding the attacks of lurking pedants, who take the shallowness of their range of ideas for the mine of all truth, and do not perceive that there are still secrets to be disclosed which open a wider perspective to the investigations of the human mind, and afford a happier resting place than is found in natural space and in these poor mortal times. With all this, it still treats the same theme, which suits the prevalent theories of science less than the regularity of ever-recurring phenomena. The author builds, like St. Ambrosius, more on fixed laws of nature than on theories floating to the winds. Thus has the author for the last 30 years moved on the still uncultivated field of the wonderful phenomena of magnetism, and after having once ascertained its reality and been convinced of the striking effects voluntarily produced by it, he believes it is his duty, in accordance with the saying, that a grain of experience is of more value in medicine than a book full of reasoning, to persevere with a certain self-sacrifice and constancy, of which not all are capable. He considered his first necessary task to be the making experiments for the discovery of a fixed law for these phenomena. As it soon appeared that such regularity really existed, the next thing required was to search in history for those similar mysterious phenomena which shew a greater or less relation to those of magnetism. General accordance is now found everywhere and at all times, and thus common laws may now be assumed for all those wonderful phenomena and problems. This justifies the axiom that all such remarkable phenomena as are in accordance with magnetism are in general true. Many other unsolved problems, of which a variety will be collected and compared in this book, appear by its means to solve themselves, or at least to be brought to a nearer comprehension. The author feels now, with a certain joy which none can repress, that he has at least done his duty, perhaps thrown some light into the obscurity, and thus given the most necessary hints for proceeding with a cautious, firm step and offering a helping hand to human weakness. If natural philosophy has of late represented magnetism not only as Tellurian, but as a general cosmical power of nature, and if she confirms this by physical reasons founded on observation, and not mere metaphysical speculation, the assertion of that magnetic seeress is no longer so absurd when she calls magnetism something more universal and higher than what is generally understood by it. Magnetism, she said, is even capable of setting free the original bright nature of man in its various parts, powers, and relations, which can then express itself in many ways and in different degrees. The power of magnetizing lies in everyone, but there must exist the power combined with the wisdom to apply it. Meanwhile, men speak of it as they do of the wind, of which they know not whence it comes nor whither it goes. Man can also make wind, but only such as has no life in it. As the author had the opportunity of hearing such decisions of magnetic seers and of making himself acquainted with the higher natural philosophy, he has endeavored to collect in this work everything that appeared to him to belong to the province of magnetism and to be susceptible of enlightenment by the torch of natural philosophy. The reader must, therefore, be requested to follow with a certain tolerance and resignation into the magical land, even if he should sometimes be led too far and into strange places. Who can invariably, and especially on such unknown ground, always attain the right goal? On the other hand, instead of a complete system filling up and philosophic enlightening, often only hints of the probable direction are given. The author has allowed himself a certain freedom because self-instruction was his principal aim. After having proceeded a certain distance, however, and being convinced of having acquired a useful scientific fact, he considered it a duty to communicate it to others, remembering the passage of Phaedrus. Nisi utalest, quod novimus stulta sapienta. The reader will not find industry and a certain circumspection wanting. By patient devotion, something at least has been done, as much at least as one individual with other necessary occupations has been able to accomplish. An ample library was necessary for the completion of the work, together with years of research and the aid of friends, and without the rich treasures of the royal library of this place, and the gratefully acknowledged readiness of its superintendents, it could never have appeared in this extended form. Copiousness, however, in a work of this kind is necessary in more than one respect. Sufficient matter must be collected to enable us to reject what is superfluous and useless. In the representation of facts, brevity is not the very first law, but rather brilliancy and distinctiveness, inasmuch as the narrator has to separate reality from fiction, what is known from what is merely invented, and to make way for conviction in the place of doubt. The author readily admits that he may at one time be too prolix, at another too concise, here have omitted or underrated a master, there have introduced or overrated an assistant. A man may have many good intentions, but few good actions. The principal endeavor is to afford the reader the means of testing the proofs for himself, and protecting himself against the prejudices of history, or those of the author. Of course, he must not, chilled by these, have lost all docile susceptibility. Neither will a reasonable reader require complete infallibility, or be astonished at a possible number of paradoxes which he may perhaps find in a man who is his own guide in these singularities, who, though unprejudiced, condemns neither party if they afford so little support, but who follows no standard or authority and is always cautious, that no name deceive him, no dogma confine, nor that life's pressing crowd change his human nature. The phenomena of magnetism are acknowledged to be of great importance to anthropology and natural philosophy, and even to moral philosophy. They're becoming so to history and even, as the reader will perceive, partly in the mystical olden time. If the world is a miracle, the history of life is a dream. We know not whither it goes, nor do we know its beginning and end. All humanity plays to a certain extent a blind game and is kept together less by clear knowledge than by the instinctive dream pole. An internal, hidden poet leads them by a secure thread through the labyrinths of time and space. Hidden in the breast of man lie the everlasting messengers of heaven and hell, who step forth now as glorified spirits to console, now as terrific monsters on his path. Hegel said somewhere, "All history is a book of dreams, a collection of dreams." And if the dreams had been collected, which men had dreamt during a certain period, a true picture of the spirit of the time would have been given. By far the greater part of mankind lives on imagination. Not only the less instructed natural men of feeling, but even those who boast of knowledge and a higher mental cultivation. How few in their feelings and sufferings, in their doings and aspirings, raise themselves in the sea of life above the world of imagination. In the literary hero of romance, among the scenes of the stage, There is no more original thought than in the persevering churchgoer. The great mass wishes to be devout and thinks that the glorification of God's name lies in miracles rather than in natural action. Dignity, riches, and power are only too much the springs of even great and eminent minds. Thus, mysterious feelings always lead man, like the dreamer and somnambulist, through the world, rather than the clear consciousness of open daylight. And as the dreamer is only struck by the momentary liveliness of the appearance, undisturbed by its causes or effects, so mankind knows no more of the dreams of the first period of its childhood. But now magnetism gives us information about the existence and action of the life of dreams and the power of creation, and in general about the sports and whims of fancy. It is also the best means of breaking the seal which closes the mysteries of antiquity, rich in fancy, whilst it discloses the similarity and depth of man's capacity, and shows an accordance of phenomena which formerly in magic was attributed to enchantment and to deceit, or to those supernatural wonders for which the philosopher could not account, and which an external religion and an inherited faith found not in their catechism. In fine, magnetism is able to give the meaning of the symbolic enigmas of ancient mysteries, which were considered quite insoluble, or which appeared matter for the most varied explanations. In the same manner, the manifold declarations of ecstatic seers and mystic philosophers, which are treasured up by persons initiated into the mysteries, will now become more intelligible by means of magnetism. The reader who is so inclined may convince himself of this if he follow the author on the wide field of magic, whilst he collects and compares the testimony and monuments of all ages. If he has not succeeded in exhausting everything and completely clearing away all darkness, bridges and windows will appear to lead us to new views, which time and the constantly increasing dexterity of magnetism will enlighten more and more. And thus, after a real search according to the command of Olympiodorus, we shall at last attain to a knowledge of heavenly things. There occur in the history of man great questions regarding the world of miracles, on the subject of which both philosophers and the religious have occupied themselves. What are miracles in nature and in the mind of man? How is the world governed? What was the inspiration of the prophets and oracles? Do these go on themselves like clockwork, or are they governed by supernatural influences? Does the divinity descend into the heart of man, or does the latter raise itself with innate strength from the dust of natural life into the high spheres of spirits? Men are astonished at unusual appearances and signs which they do not comprehend. But does such astonishment always imply a real miracle? Most men have the miracle in their mind and worship it because it is enveloped in a sacred obscurity. They only admire nature because they are of opinion that she is an inexplicable enchantment, whilst they set but small value on what they consider intelligible. On the other hand, there are even philosophers who admit of no miracle, and who pass their lives in believing nothing, not even believing what they see, especially if they do not understand it. The most wonderful point about these is that their own brain is not a miracle to them. In nature, as well as in the mind, regular phenomena occur, which are looked upon as wonders only on account of their rarity, because it is not known how they come about. The best thing that can be said of miracles is the answer given by Christ to Nicodemus. That which is born of the flesh is flesh, and that which is born of the spirit is spirit. The wind bloweth where it listeth, and thou hearest the sound thereof, but canst not tell whence it cometh, nor whither it goeth. Like the fathers in Israel, the new fathers do not willingly take cognizance of things which are not part of their faith, and which are out of their horizon, whether temporal or heavenly things be in question. A seeress expresses herself remarkably well on this point. If anyone seeks miracles, he will find them in everything that would appear very natural to him, if he had more knowledge of himself, of nature, and of the providence of God. Another who thinks highly of this reason does not admit anything miraculous. He must understand and explain everything by his reason, even if he cannot be so understood and explained. And whenever he fails in this, he contradicts and denies. It is certainly very difficult always to decide what are natural and what are directly divine operations. And thus one can understand that most persons unacquainted with the laws of nature call everything a miracle which they cannot measure by their own standard. On the other hand, miracles often consist of reports magnified by lies and propagated by superstition. Thus it happens that even by the more educated, certain uncommon phenomena are ignored or even denied. For the knowledge of the regularity of all unusual phenomena is attained not so much by ideas as by profound tranquility, by observation and laborious experience, which require long to strike root and to bear fruit. A certain religious sect is of opinion that one must not infringe too much on the faith in miracles, without reflecting that by Christ and the apostles we are not referred to signs and wonders, but to the research after truth, retaining what is good, and to the active spirit of love. Another sect thinks that a prophetic illumination would decide only for the good, that man has no natural impulse to prophecy, and that where a prognostication appears, except among Orthodox devotees, it is a false prophecy in league with evil spirits, a kind of supernatural lightning called enchantment. The reader will in this work be led into the great ill-famed land of the marvelous. He will be faithfully informed how those magical prophecies of the heathen oracles, and then how the demoniacal powers of necromancy and of the Christian witchcraft, at different times and among different nations, were brought about. In these days, a kind of twilight shines on those hidden performances, which philosophic poets, poetical philosophers, and enthusiastic theologists are emulously stirring up by imagination, symbolism, and mysticism. Not merely the bare facts will be here recorded, but as much as possible the natural progress of them explained, in order that the miraculous prophecies of the oracle be no longer ascribed to the gods, but the causes be found in human nature itself and in its inborn attributes. Man possesses a susceptibility dependent on natural and mental stimulus, from which arises sometimes from an innate disposition, a low, imperfect, or even through divine impulse, a higher and more complete prophesying, prophetic inspiration. The pathological condition of the demoniacal enchanters and sorcerers may also be explained as natural events. They are abnormal, unusual affections of the mind which often resemble illumination. Thus, the usual mental powers of man arise from the depths of the spiritual world, over the smooth mirror of the soul. Through time and space and the unusually excited senses palpitate like the lightning which casts its flashes and waves, often on the most distant shores, sending a magic brightness, which one is more willing to consider supernatural than to ascribe to a fixed law of nature. Psychologists have had still less success hitherto in explaining the spiritual than physiologists the natural lightning, which formerly was also ascribed to Jupiter and the symbolic gods. The intensity and vastness of the human mind are not fathomed by the most faithful observations of physiologists. And these psychological wonders are still frequently enough ascribed to the gods. The mind of man is simple in its character, like the spirit of God and of nature, but manifold are its powers in action. And thus the spirit of prophecy pervades all history and springs from the lawful power of humanity itself, in which the impulse alone is occasional, proceeding either from nature or directly by God's choice. One must not be enamored of prophecy, either on account of its show or for its importance. Neither must one undervalue it, for it affords always a sort of intimation of truth and some proof of divine providence, which strengthens faith and awakens the hope of a future. That such revelations and unusual action take place, even in sleep and in abnormal conditions, is even less to be wondered at, for the spirit itself has eyes before and behind, and sleep is only action checked by the heaviness of the exhausted natural body, for the spirit, freed from this weight, has no peace day or night. The unusually developed powers of the mind do not certainly admit of being so exactly defined in their source and tendency, as in the case with the elementary powers of nature, with magnetism and electricity. Yet the strength of the mind is on that account no less certain, and is proved by the power of the word, when one can neither weigh nor measure it. Now there are diversities of gifts, but the same Spirit, and there are diversities of operations, but it is the same God which worketh all in all. But the manifestation of the Spirit is given to every man to profit withal. 1 Corinthians 12. Nothing is better calculated to furnish examples of the misapprehended magical state and of its miracle faith in supernatural agencies than the history of witchcraft. That man was only a passive toy of demoniacal powers was universally acknowledged, and even defended by positive divinity and polemics. I have treated this subject more especially according to its historical origin and anthropological causes, and with regard to time and place. Whereas up to this time it has been represented very imperfectly and in fragments, and without regard to any scientific explanation. In order to find the origin and progress of the idea of witchcraft, I certainly had to return to remotest antiquity, in fact, to the physical and mythological foundation, and perhaps the reader will sometimes think my proceedings hazardous, as on this somewhat unstable ground, deductions from similar modern phenomena are introduced. I regret not being able any longer to make use of the excellent work of Dr. Will Gott-Soldow, History of Witchcraft Represented from Its Sources, Stuttgart and Tübingen, 1843. Soldow also shows circumstantially that the history of witchcraft is not only a national but a magical human history, that witchcraft is a phenomena of Christendom, which, if it is to be understood, must not be represented as belonging to a single people, nor as beginning from that period when it appears as something already complete. The phenomena of sorcery are not isolated facts. They are not only in close connection with the general state of cultivation, but branch out into innumerable points of contact with church history, with the history of crime, of medicine, and thus of natural philosophy. Soldow also shows from church history how enchantments and heretical abominations proceeded from religious views, and from previous accusation, how they were progressively cultivated and led step by step to a point whence it appears but one leap, if two tales of heresy were even added to the disgraceful, pernicious magic arts as realities, so that in the 13th century these heretical vices were even included in magic. He shows further how in the first centuries of Christianity, the fathers of the church, rabbis, and heathen philosophers lost themselves and rivaled each other in demonological speculations and beliefs, represented miracles and sorceries, so that everyone looked on what was agreeable as a miracle and the reverse as a sorcery. Sorcery was illegal miracle and miracle legitimate sorcery. The fathers of the church looked upon the heathen oracles and the heathens on the Christian miracles as sorcery. Thus, by degrees, the foundation of a system was laid, which, projected under many contradictions, formed the indictments of the famous witch trials, of which its commencements and resting points are to be found in the East, among the Jews and the Greeks, and also in Northern mythology. So that sorcery has always existed, if not in the world, at least in the minds of men. Some readers may perhaps be surprised that I have taken so little notice of a new work of J. Gore's, Christian Mysticism, 5 volumes, Regensburg and Landshut, since it at least moves in similar mystic regions and treats more in detail several subjects, such as the reciprocal connection between men and the extraordinary alternation of effects, visions and ecstasies, the abnormal affections of sleep and of the senses, etc. The work will be very instructive to the reader in every respect, and especially as completing the history of magic, but my present object is neither the nature of mysticism nor its history. Consequently, the groundwork and the subjects of this book are very different, as well as its tendency and aim. I start from personal observations, wander about on the vital and productive field of nature, seek everywhere the analogies and relations of phenomena, and the laws which govern them. Descend then, as well and as far as I can, into the deepest and darkest pits of history. Place them in rows side by side for inspection, in order to make prominent the character of the harmony or contrast according to its principles. The most active principle, however, of these magic phenomena I have found mostly on anthropological ground, where nature and the action of fancy produce the wonders which transport the supernaturalist completely into the transcendental and supernatural, but the rationalist absolutely denies if he does not understand them. The above-named work treats of the history of mysticism, in tales and traditions where criticism exercises no great severity. Now the purport of all mysticism is the wide, flowery field of all sensuous images and of religious metaphysics, generally whereby the connection and union with God shall be assured more by feelings and faith than by the free conceptions of the understanding. Christian mysticism is only a single form according to its doctrine, and the elaborations of its history represent it again according to its confessional and spiritual point of view. Thus, Gores seeks to cover mysticism with a glittering poetical web. Mysticism is, according to him and the Catholic doctrine, nothing more than a gospel reflected in the saints, an undulation and vibration lasting for ages and moving in increasing circles of the movement originated by Christ. Mysticism is, according to Gores, a contemplation assisted by higher light, an action through higher freedom. The singular phenomena of contemplation and action which occurred among pious Christians are miracles of a higher unseen power. As most, if not all, unusual phenomena belong to the realm of magic, and are found not only among Christians but also among the heathen, they must follow a general law, and such uncommon physical natural phenomena can be no miracles, certainly much less so than the Christian regeneration of the spirit itself. Even to the agency of a strange objective spirit world is attributed much which certainly belongs to the subjective fancy of man. Religious visions and ecstasies are related to those of magnetism, and in their principles differ perhaps only in the rarest instances, from physical pathological conditions, from the exaggerated aesthetic and ecstasy-reaching exercises, from subjective illusory chimeras. Many saints have obviously not been free, and the separation of the natural sensuous and the supernatural divine leads us into a field where doubts and contentions about miracles begin, where it can no longer be apodictically decided how much is natural phenomena and how much the agency of divine grace, if one permits supernatural influences to outbid the natural powers. For man possesses a completely incomprehensible, positive, innate, generally latent, vital power, which in proportion to its power of extension pervades the immeasurable. Nature rests on such an inborn basis and order, that so her most entangled and abnormal effects proceed rather from her own regularity than are the consequence of supernatural spiritual powers, which only fortuite fatalité make game of her as a passive tool. There is in the conception of life more than supernaturalism believes and less than rationalism admits. Divine quality already exists in the substance of natural life. But even divine influences are not on that account excluded, because everything receives life from God and through God. The mutually influencing causes and effects of divine and natural, spiritual and physical power are mostly concealed in obscurity, impenetrable to the understanding. Thus fancy retains the power voluntarily and at pleasure of ascribing every unusual appearance to a transcendent principle, in correspondence with a religious feeling and a national point of view. This was the case with the mythological elementary powers, and thus it is still with the inexplicable physiological enigmas. A pathological phenomena is frequently erroneously regarded as a divine revelation, and degrades the objective outward cause among living beings, where only subjective powers proceed from their singularity. It appears to me, therefore, most prudent, in the contemplation of the world and history, to render the mystical scientific rather than science mystical, by which means we shall observe the powers of nature and of the mind by their phenomena and reciprocal action, and thus discover their mutual conditions. Above all, we have to hold fast by nature's point of view, without, however, mixing up God and the world, or amalgamating them in the pantheistical unity. Thus it seems advisable neither to take refuge too much in the sublimities of transcendentalism, nor yet, on the other hand, to stagnate in spiritless matter. Not alone to trust to the prevailing feelings and the luster of fantasy, nor yet blindly to follow the power of faith as a lodestar, and at the same time just as little to accept everything as unrefutable truth, which can only be decided by reflection and cool understanding, which everywhere affects a defiant self-will and a faultless independence. Both the extremes, pietism and rationalism, are the farthest removed from nature and from God, and their fruits have never yet brought a blessing or a comfort into the world. True magic lies in the most secret, inmost powers of our mind, but our spiritual nature is not yet revealed to us. All spiritual wonders are lost at last in the wonders of our own mind. Mysticism is common property. All men are mystics, but true mysticism consists in the direct relation of the human mind to God, in the idea of the absolute, in which, however, objective revelation contains no more than corresponds with the subjective powers of man. My criterion of false mysticism is that it accomplishes no true community and propitiation between God and man. True mysticism must include the idea of truth and goodness, of beauty and virtue, as beams of all spiritual perfection and religious self-consciousness, as a universally illuminating center must penetrate the whole spiritual organism. Magnetism introduces us to the mysteries of magic and contains on one side a key to the most hidden secrets of nature, as on the other, it is adapted to exhibit mysticism and the wonders of the creative spirit. Imago Magia Magnis. Munich, 21st October, 1843. Part 1. Of Magic and Its Branches in General. Magusia, Magusi, signified the office and knowledge of the priest, who was called Mage, Magius, Magusi, and afterwards Magi and Magician. Brucker maintains that the primitive meaning of this word is fire worshipper, worship of the light, to which erroneous opinion he has been led by the Mohammedan dictionaries. Neither is magic to be derived directly from the Magi, which was an error on the part of the Romans. The word Mag was used by Jeremias to indicate a Babylonian priest. In the modern Persian, the word is Mog, and Mogbed signifies high priest. The high priest of the Parsis at Surat, even at the present day, is called Mobed. Others derive the word from Meg, Meheb, signifying something which is great and noble, and Zoroaster's disciples were called Megastom. Among the Parsis, the Medes, and Egyptians, a higher knowledge of nature was understood by the term magic, with which religion and particularly astronomy were associated. The initiated and their disciples were called magicians, that is, the wise, which was also the case among the Greeks. It is thus that Plato praises the Theosebia. Lucian calls them genus mentacon kai theologian, etc., and Cicero, sapientium e doctorum genus magorum habitur in Persis. That renowned wisdom of the Magi in Persia, Media, and the neighboring countries, therefore, contained also the secret teachings of philosophy and the sciences, which were only communicated to priests, who were regarded as mediators between God and man, and as such, and on account of their knowledge, were highly respected. It is easily to be imagined that, as the subtle workings of nature and the movements of the heavenly bodies were perfectly unknown by the people, the idea of magic, which runs always connected with astrology, should be readily formed. The Magi are to be met with in the most ancient traditions of the Old World, India, Persia, Chaldea, and Egypt, were the cradles of the oldest magic. Zoroaster, Austenes, the Brahmins, the Chaldean sages, and the Egyptian priests were the primitive possessors of its secrets. The priestly and sacrificial functions, healing of the sick, and the preservation of secret wisdom were the objects of their life. They were either princes themselves or surrounded princes as their counselors. Justice, truth, and the power of self-sacrifice were the great qualities with which each one of these must be endowed. The neglect of any one of these virtues was punished in the most cruel manner. Cambyses, for instance, commanded the execution of a priest who had allowed himself to be bribed and had his skin stretched over the chair in which his son and successor sat in his judicial capacity. That magic was very early associated with medicine is shown by Pliny, who even traces its origin to that science. Natum primum in medicina nemo dubitat magium. However, this idea was not always connected with it. Plato understood by wisdom nothing less than a worship of the divinity, therapia theon, and Apuleius says that magus means, in the Persian language, a priest. The common belief, however, was that which included all occult science under the name of magic. Later, under this title, was understood enchantment and any extraordinary operations, such as making gold, exorcising spirits, etc., so that magic was divided into white and black. To the latter belonged reading the hand, evil eye, power over the elements, and the transformation of human beings into animals. Magic has often been erroneously considered as exclusively of Persian origin, which error Plato appears to have originated. He says, when the boy is 14 years of age, those take charge of him who are called royal instructors. These are four of the oldest and most distinguished men. One of the wisest, the second the most just, the third the most moderate, and the fourth the bravest. One of these instructs him in the magic of Zoroaster, the son of Oromazes, which is the service of the gods. It is certain that Plato did not understand by this the present acceptation of the term, for he could not include among the services of the gods the power of changing men into animals or demons. This meaning was only given to it by the new Platonic theory, which, with the Kabbalah, became the principal source from which the theosophic and theurgic teachings, as well as the later belief in magic, have sprung. So says Heracles, the customs of religion are means to obtain the telestian virtues, by which men become demons. The theories of spiritual apparitions and the transition of demons into the human body take their rise in the philosophy of Heraclitus, according to whom demons are attracted by matter. It was thus that later the commonly received idea of magic arose, the possession of supernatural powers, such as belong to the higher spirits, and which they occasionally impart to men under certain circumstances. Among the supernatural powers was reckoned that of predicting the future, and that of acting directly upon others, even at a distance. And on this account, magic may be separated into seeing and acting. The original and the higher description of magic was, in fact, grounded on this aphorism. Man may become, by the assistance and cooperation of spiritual powers and the capacities of his higher divine origin, capable of a higher sphere of activity, as well without as within himself, which gives him dominion over his own and over surrounding nature. Taken in this sense, we find magic in the earliest ages as one of the prominent universal properties of man. Not alone in Persia, but throughout the whole East, although Persia and Chaldea may possibly have been its most fruitful and congenial ground. In this sense, Pythagoras and his disciples were, at a later period, considered as teachers of good or wise magic. The lower, or black magic, however, originated in the early times. And man, becoming conscious of his unusual powers, and without knowing their boundaries, was easily inclined to ascribe them to foreign and supernatural influences, to demons, and according to his nature, he would use them for good or evil purposes. Either deceived himself or as a magician deceiving others. Everything which could be considered as wonderful, as the incomprehensible workings of natural powers in the magnet, or the divinatory wand, or any surprising action was considered at a later period as magic, and particularly as black magic or the black art. We will now regard ancient magic more closely, and that from historical sources. Afterwards, its more important branches, particularly visions, soothsaying, and influence through the mind, through words, verbum, morificum, and by means of amulets. That magic descended by tradition from the early ages is shown everywhere by the primitive records of the human race. It is so intimately connected with the nature of man that we can only feel surprised that the learned should doubt it and think it requisites to ascribe everything to mythos, as if tradition had no deeper or firmer foundation. Thus it was that Eberhardt maintained that he had discovered the sources of magical art and its theory in the Platonic mythos of Timaeus, and that no tradition reaches any higher. According to him, the germ of the new Platonic theory of the Kabbalah, of theosophy and magic, even down to the time of Mesmer and his adherents, may be discovered in it. According to Eberhardt, a fiction is a myth which is accepted on account of its supernatural teachings or its antiquity, and which is therefore regarded as an undisputed fact, because its real origin is far beyond the perception or circle of vision of those who believe in it. By such a course of reasoning, it would not be difficult to understand everything, and even if any one fact defied explanation, it might be pushed back upon mythos, till any one chose to bring it back again to daylight. In the same degree that Eberhardt gets rid of magic with the greatest ease, so does another writer extend its bounds till it includes that which never had any connection with it. According to Tiedemann, the powers of magic are expressly these: to cure sickness with very little medicine or without any, to know future and hidden things, to find buried treasure of gold and silver, in short, to understand all nature and to do everything that is great and magnificent. It is easy to see from this how magic may be divided. Wherever a boundary is reached and wherever a new fact is met with, there will also be a new class of magic. The most important, however, are the various kinds of soothsaying, the power of causing and curing diseases, of exercising spirits and understanding alchemy. Although we do not associate with magic the gypsy art of reading the hand and the science of making gold or discovering the philosopher's stone, yet it comprises much more than that which the reason of a sensible person might allow to pass unquestioned, or reject as pure nonsense and absurdity. And this is that wonderful power of the human mind, to look into the future, or influence others without material means. This natural power of man is, however, not frequently met with, and is not of that kind which every mind is able to appreciate, according to its value and power. The knowledge of such rare phenomena and their causes could therefore in remote times only be known to the highest sages and rulers, who preserved it among their secret learning and transmitted it to their children under the cloak of religion, with which all their secrets were covered. As we have original, though meager, records of the mythological belief of the oldest nations of Asia, it will be necessary to see where and of what kind they are. The Grecian mythology is a later and certainly mixed source, and if we received it as contained in the Platonic mythos, we should be far from the light of truth. Plato, in his philosophical dialogues, as, for instance, in that on the various states of the human soul, etc., does not treat of the subject from a mythic and historic point of view, but rather endeavors by his investigations to make a beautiful whole, to leave no portion of his theory, and to make it agreeable both to probability and popular belief. Just as little need we look for the source of magic to the new Platonic philosophies, which derived the ideas of the macrocosm and the microcosm from Plato's Timaeus, the Pythagoric philosophy of demons, that of Heraclitus concerning spirits, and maintained the sympathy of the human body with the earth and with the miraculous powers of pictures and statues, and ascribed great virtue to certain words for raising spirits. Neither from the later Christian history of magic in the Middle Ages, the sylphs, gnomes, nymphs, and salamanders of Paracelsus, borrowed from Plato's Phaedrus, or Agrippa's Occulta Philosophia, or Faust's Compulsion of Hell, or Petro di Albano's Heptameron, shall we have any aid? It is, however, certain that in all the later, as well as in the earlier Platonic, Pythagorean, mythical speculations, some truth formed the basis, while beyond that, everything is but the empty fancy and dreaming of superstition. To convince ourselves of this, we will return to the earlier ages of the East, to the nations of Egypt, and seek in their records, as well as in the Israelitish history, for traces of magic, of mental vision and activity. Subjects which will be discussed, I shall endeavor to arrange in historical order, that, as a whole, they may firstly have reference to the nature of our magic, and secondly, that each fact may throw as much light as possible upon the others. We have no immediate and authentic source to which we may refer for the myths and mysteries of the ancient nations, and yet the study must be carried farther back than it is at the present, to the fathers of the church and the Gnostics, or even to Plato. Among the Egyptians and Orientals we find but fragments, though in such numbers that we are able to decide that it is among the nations of the East that we must search for earlier traces, and even for their origin. We shall subsequently endeavor to prove more fully this proposition. According to the latest investigations, the very earliest records are to be met with in the Zend Avesta, the laws of Manu, and the Jewish traditions of the Kabbalah. As I shall have to refer at a later time to the above-mentioned Oriental records, we will now take a somewhat nearer view of the Kabbalah and examine some of its principal teachings, which are not alone of great importance to theology, but to philosophy in general and magic in particular. We will let the opinion that the earliest philosophers, as Pythagoras and Plato, drew upon the Kabbalah, although possibly indirectly, rest upon its own merits. And the latest inquiries have shown, at all events, that the traditions of Judaism belong to the earliest sources of the mysteries. Schelling says in his work on the divinities of Samothrace, how, if in the Grecian mythology the ruins of a superior intelligence and even a perfect system were to be found, which would reach far beyond the horizon which most the ancient written records present to us, and at the same time, he suggested that possibly some portions of the system might be discovered in the Jewish philosophy, or the so-called Kabbalah. Franz von Baader even says, not only our salvation, but our science itself came to us from the Jews. At all events, the fathers of the church and the Gnostics had their allegorical interpretation of the Kabbalah. For Origen says, and Hilarius repeats, that although Moses committed the contents of the covenant to writing, yet he also communicated some weighty secrets from the hidden depths of the law to the 70 elders, ordaining them to be their repositories and perpetual teachers. Jerome turned to the Jews of Tiberias and Lydda, more especially to a certain Barabbas, not alone for aid in the Hebrew tongue, but to learn their mystical manner of interpretation. The writings of Dionysius Areopagita have palpably been grounded on the Jewish Kabbalah. In the Christian Middle Ages, the greater part were probably but continuations of that which had already been borrowed from the Kabbalah. Although Johannes Scultus, Erigena, Albertus Magnus, Raymond Lully, and others appear to have been persecuted, and others appear to have prosecuted individual inquiries. Later, however, when the study of the old classics was held in great esteem, Johann Reuchlin devoted himself with great ardor to the investigation of the Kabbalah, and has embodied the results in his work entitled De Verbo Morifico and De Arte Kabbalistica. Buxdorf, Schickard, Hottinger, Athanasius, Kircher, and many others followed in his footsteps, and with Knorr von Rosenroth, whose work Kabbalah Denudata is of great merit, endeavored to unravel the mysteries of the Kabbalah. The philosophies of Agrippa von Nettesheim, of Paracelsus, of Van Helmont, and Jacob Bohm all bear striking resemblance to the Jewish teachings. And of all those, Jacob Bohm, the shoemaker of Gorlitz, possessed the deepest and most comprehensive knowledge of the Christian mystics and theosophers, and probably was made acquainted with the Kabbalah by his friend Balthasar Walter, who was thoroughly versed in Oriental knowledge. To the above may also be added Porlage, Martinez, Pashali, St. Martin, and Henry Moore, who were all acute and skillful searchers into the mysteries of the Jewish esoteric doctrines. No one, however, has rendered greater service than Professor Molitor in his philosophy of history and traditions. Although Molitor's researches were principally directed towards the wonderful revelations of religion and philosophy, yet the Kabbalah does not the less contain many facts which bear great reference to natural philosophy and possess deep interest for us. In it, we find the principal outlines of the later magic, and more especially witchcraft, which is perfectly represented, on which account we may be excused for entering somewhat more at large into the subject. The age of inconsequence and shallowness in theology as well as in sciences is past, says Molitor, and since that revolutionary rationalism has left nothing behind but its own emptiness, after having destroyed everything positive, it seems now to be the time to direct our attention anew to that mysterious revelation which is the living spring whence our salvation has proceeded. Such an investigation, carried out with an elevated spirit into the mysteries of ancient Israel, which contain all the secrets of modern Israel, would be particularly calculated to rouse the elements of Christianity, to found the fabric of theology upon its deepest theosophical principles, and to give a firm basis to all ideal sciences. It would aid in opening a new path to the true history of mankind, and would serve as the first step to a more complete understanding of the obscure labyrinth of the myths, mysteries, and constitutions of primitive nations. The Kabbalah appears to consist of patriarchal traditions, and to embrace more particularly the following subjects: the sacred idea of God and of divine natures, the primitive spiritual creation and the first spiritual fall, the origin of darkness, chaos, and renewed creation of the world and the 6 days of creation, the creation of material man, his fall, and the will of God for his salvation, and the restoration of the primitive harmony and the ultimate bringing back of all creation to God. Molitor continues to say that the writings of the ancients had not the intention of explaining the whole depth of a subject, but rather of giving its most important essence, that on this account they were short and simple, but of weighty importance and unintelligible to everyone who wished to study them without a teacher, and that even the whole spirit of knowledge was only imparted to the scholars verbally in that degree which their capacities enabled them to receive, and that especially in the highest and holiest interest of humanity, in religion, the written laws were accompanied by unwritten explanations. He also gives the criterion by which to distinguish the true from the false traditions, and then says that in this tradition was contained the system of the schools of the prophets, which the prophet Samuel did not found, but only restored, whose end was no other than to lead the scholars to wisdom and the highest knowledge, and, when they had been found worthy, to induct them into the deeper mysteries. Classed with these mysteries was magic, which was of a double nature: divine magic, or the true inspiration of the good and evil magic, or the black art, which endeavors to raise the obscure earthy to an unfettered existence. Each of these is again divisible into two kinds, the active and seeing. In the first, man endeavors to place himself en rapport with the world, to learn hidden things. In the latter, he endeavors to gain power over spirits. In the former, to perform good and beneficial acts, in the latter, to do all kinds of diabolical and unnatural deeds. The Kishup, or higher magical influence, is divided into two principal classes, an elementary and a spiritual. The latter proceeds from below upwards, from without inwards, from the material to the spiritual. The former comes from above to within, from the spiritual to the physical. With the former, evil spirits are the agencies, and they lend their aid as they do in every bad deed. The Kishup consists also in exorcism, by which things are hindered in their principles and actions are turned aside or bound and given into the power of Satan. According to the teachings of the Kabbalah, laying a curse upon men, creating hatred and enmity, causing pain and illness or death in animals or men, producing storms and hail, are all of this nature. Many sorcerers are said to change themselves into the semblance of animals and to journey great distances in a short time. Magic also made use of outward means, particularly of salves and oils and metals, each one of which had a particular property, and the strangest things could be done by mixing them. It says further, there are women who make a contract with the Shadim and meet them at certain times, dance with them, and visit these spirits who appear to them in the shape of goats. In many countries, such women are killed, a foreshadowing of the witch trials of modern times. For although their crime is no outward one, yet the penalty of death is awarded to them in Exodus 22:17. For such have given themselves wholly to Satan, page 287. The material kishup consists of disturbing influences upon the elements of nature by means of the excitement of false rapport in various substances. By such sacrilegious encroachments of the natural elements, life is not only made miserable, but the laws of nature are distorted and wronged. The first class is called sorcery, in the narrow acceptation, and is alone practiced by masters of the black art. The second class, on the contrary, under the name of the evil sympathy, is found to be very widely spread among all Oriental nations. But all kinds of sorcery proceed from the serpent, on which account they are called arts of the serpent. The magic sight is also of two classes, when man either places himself in immediate connection with an evil spirit, or by means of such a spirit communicates with the dead. For spirits have knowledge which is unknown to man. Often, however, they pretend to know future things, for the purpose of deceiving men with lies or intentionally distort truth. The exorcists must prepare themselves before they commence their labors, and the best time for all sorcery is from 10:30 to midnight, when the world of darkness has the greatest strength. Yet powerful sorcerers have the power over spirits after 2:00 in the afternoon. The conjuring of spirits can either take place inwardly, or the spirit may be made to appear visibly, as in magnetic somnambulism. In the inward method of exorcism, the magician produces unconsciousness by outward means, and the spirit enters into and speaks from him, possession. This kind is called idoni, the forbidden sorcery and witchcraft, 3 Moses 19:21. In the second class, or the regular citation of bad spirits, the magicians spread a table with food and drink, burn incense, and the spirits then assemble and answer questions. Sorcerers often use staves, with which they strike upon the earth to rouse the spirits, and often also creep upon about the ground. Generally, they rise with disheveled hair, their limbs are convulsed, make strange movements, or cut themselves to attract spirits. Page 289. In every respect, a perfect description of Virgil's sibyls and the convulsive movements of magnetic sleepers. The incense must never be omitted, as in the case of the Egyptian and Greek oracles, for it has great power of attracting those dark forms, and partly it helps to prepare the atmosphere, so that the spirits may become visible, as every spirit must attract matter. Not less do magicians use blood, particularly that of human beings, as it is the seat of life and a delight and nourishment for the Shadim. And when the sorcerer gives himself up to Satan, he signs with his blood. In the black art, man does not remain a passive instrument of evil spirits, but is an active and working agent. We find that many practice sorcery and succeed, while others do the same and fail. So that to do such things, one must be naturally inclined. As everyone has not the same magnetic powers, and not all magnetic subjects present the same phenomena. According to the Kabbalah, man is enabled by his nature to look into the realms of the supernatural and the invisible, as well as to act magically above and below. According to Jacob Bohm, into the realms of light and darkness. As the Almighty fills the whole universe, beholds, and yet is unseen, so does the soul, in Shemak, fill the whole body, and itself sees without being visible. The soul looks also where the bodily eye is unable to see. Occasionally a sudden terror falls upon man without his being able to divine the cause. Presentiments. From the fact that the soul foresees a misfortune, the soul also possesses the power of acting upon the materials of this world, to destroy one form and to create another. Man is even able to injure other things, or to destroy men by his imagination. The New Platonists, Paracelsus, and others make the same remarks. There have always been men, says the Kabbalah, who have been furnished with greater or lesser powers for good or evil. For as a preeminence in good or evil requires a peculiar strength of mind, we find that such men are the heroes and priests in the kingdom of Tuma, that is, of the pure or impure. When, therefore, man directs his strivings towards the divine, he is, in the degree to which he does not act egotistically but looks unswervingly towards the heavenly, filled by divine grace with supernatural power. And if such a man has the natural disposition, he may, by the power of his soul, communicate with the divine and angelic world. Religious Mystics, Swedenborg. And then, according to his greater or less capacity and the divine intentions, receive impressions and revelations, and at the same time, according to the strength of these circumstances, be filled with a higher spiritual energy. For it is the highest and last end of our existence, that man should again be placed in connection with his original source, and raised from the material earthy to the highest step of spiritual existence. This higher step of spiritual existence is called especially the pure divine mania. An insufficient disposition for higher impressions may, however, be remedied by the divine pleasure. For we often see that God calls those to him who were straying from him and endows them with extraordinary powers. A difference must be drawn between that gift of the seer, which perceives things concealed from the senses by the material obstacles of space or time, and that higher species of divination, which recognizes events to be brought about in the future through man's free will. It is true that by means of the inner sense, man, when he is freed from the outer senses, becomes easily influenced by spiritual powers, and thereby is enabled to look into hidden things and foretell their intrinsic qualities, their consequent results. Therefore, the Kabbalah teaches that not alone does every human action produce its consequences, but that each event since the beginning of the world inscribes itself in a higher sphere, and that thus future events may be foretold through the reading of the past. But there are limits to this species of vision, since the inner man is alone affected by that to which he is kindred. The freer, purer is the inner man, the wider is his immediate sphere of vision and sphere of action. When his own power no longer avails him, he requires the assistance of foreign spiritual influence, in order that his inward vision may be extended. Thus it becomes clear why, either under natural or induced circumstances, foreign spiritual agency is generally present. But the decrees of God can never be fathomed by man, unless God deigns to vouchsafe a revelation. Otherwise, the power of prophecy would be no operation of the divine power, but simply the natural consequence of the exaltation of mind, which momentarily has penetrated into the sphere of eternity, and there recognized the far distant future. And such is the belief of the Indian seers. This view of prophecy would be entirely opposed to all religious faith. The divine power reveals itself both in an inner, subjective, and an external, objective manner, by means of the first. Although this power of vision and divination is a universal one in human nature, it is found, however, in various degrees of intensity. In order to produce magical results, according to the Kabbalah, a very firm will is requisite, as Paracelsus teaches, so as to attract the very highest spiritual influence and to react upon it. The will of the operator must also be completely in harmony with his object, and alone be directed towards it. A very powerful and vivid imagination is also requisite. The same qualities are required in the seer. The seer's spirit, body, and soul must be in the most harmonious accord with the objects of his vision. The soul must not, therefore, busy itself too much with external matters. The imagination must be strong, lively and clear, in order that the impression of the spiritual world may remain clear and sharp, and be not destroyed by foreign images. It is on this account that enchanters love solitude, and seek in every way to withdraw themselves from the outward, and to cultivate their imagination. Especially does the Kabbalah teach that the man must be fitted for such things. Balaam was so, but with a false power, for he had a defect in his sight, which, according to Sohar, is to say that he had an imperfection in his spirit, of which the external imperfection was but the objective expression. In this sense, the Kabbalah maintains that every follower of the black art must have something imperfect or diseased about him. Very remarkable are the teachings of the Kabbalah regarding the weak points at times offered to Satan through the actions of man, regarding citation of the dead and uncleanness, especially in the case of the woman. With regard to the latter, man is the positive and operative principle, and therefore, compared with the sun and light, woman stands opposed to him as a restraining power, without whom he would be lost in an immeasurable and boundless speculation, forgetful of his highest relationship. Woman is man reversed, his mirrored image. Whilst he is a self-acting principle, productively striving outwards and ever seeking the universal, the infinite, the woman is the negative principle, acting from without inwards. From the circumference to the center, receptive, ready from man's expansive energy to reduce concrete forms. Thus, by the Jews, is woman called the house of the man. And the Talmud designates woman as the wall which is created around man. Man and woman are an inseparable whole, one forming the ideal, the other the real. In man, the ideal has sway, in woman, feeling. Thus, she adheres more to the concrete and external and has an innate living sense. She is possessed of an inward presentiment of the world. Thus, she is endowed with an unerring tact and arrives at maturity sooner than man, who desires to attain all knowledge through his own exertions. The aspiration of woman is towards the pure and the noble, and she attracts to herself man who is ever seeking after that peculiar nature with which she as woman is endowed. And this she does, not in order to retain him in a lower sphere, but to ascend with him into a higher. And if, on one hand, woman is an encircling wall to man, on the other, she is his guide, wandering by his side through the labyrinths of life, and by her gentleness, patience, and love, softening and restraining his fiery impatience of character. In this sense, woman is called the crown of man. High as is the destiny of woman, yet she has a closer affinity to the night side of nature than man, and it is especially exposed to the temptations of Satan. Deceit, curiosity, indiscretion, the desire to enslave man by her charms and to see the creations of her imagination realized are the shadow side and incline her to the study and practice of forbidden knowledge. Night, sleep, and dreams affect women also more than man, and therefore the power of the seer is of commoner occurrence with her than with man. According to the Kabbalah, besides angels, there are intermediate spirits, the spirits of the elements. The Shadim of the Jews are divided into four classes, the chief of whom is Asmodi. The first class contains the spirits of the fire, the second of fire and air, the third of fire, air, and water, the fourth have a mineral ingredient. This is completely the doctrine of Paracelsus. The spirits of the two last classes are possessed mostly of evil natures and are fond of causing injury to man. The other two are possessed of greater wisdom, and knowing many of the secrets of nature, willingly disclose them to man. The lower class of element spirits, coming into frequent contact with man, are at times dangerous and spiteful, and thus man sacrifices to them in order to gain their favor. According to the Kabbalah, everything that exists, whether great or small, stands in a magical union with the rest of nature. Everywhere is the external, the operation of the internal, and the external reacts upon the internal. Magic, as well as seeing, is directed towards the earthly as well as towards the supernatural. External magical visions consists in reading the future through the aspects and changes of objects, and which is subdivided into earthly and heavenly objects. The one is called Monen, computation of time, and comprehends astrology. The other is called Nichush, prophetic indication. Secondly, soothsaying teaches that nothing occurs accidentally, but that events and all nature stand in secret connection with each other. Thus, the career of clouds, as well as the flight of birds and the cries and movements of animals, become objects of soothsaying, and it asserts that the animal sees more than the external eye of ordinary man. Birds, especially standing in connection with the spirits of the air, are prophetic. Birds of prey being peculiarly adapted to Nechush. All events occurring to man and which produce agreeable or disagreeable impressions belong to the same class. Man can convert himself into Nechush by saying, if so and so happened to me, it will be either a good or bad omen. The inward visionary natural magic consists in man being brought into connection with the spiritual world through artificial means. And here also are various degrees. The lowest degree of this magic is the withdrawing the soul from the outer world through external means and manipulation. The means are various. According to Maimonides and others, to this species of magic belong digging in sand, the casting of lots, reading cards, gazing in mirrors, in polished blades and arrows, or anything that is bright. This divining by lots is only brought about through the correspondence of the external art with the inner arrangement of things. A second higher degree is necromancy, questioning of the dead, for which the preparation of fasting is necessary. It is also customary to sleep upon the graves or to burn incense upon them, repeating certain formula the while. The third and highest is when man, after necessary preparation and the withdrawal of himself from external objects, unites himself with the spirits of nature to receive revelations from them. Active magic is divided into a lower natural and a higher spiritual magic. The first consists in exciting magical rapport by physical means. To this belongs first sympathetic healing. The spiritual magic proceeds directly from the inner being and may also be divided into two kinds. In the first, man operates principally through his innate power, but not without the assistance of the element spirits. In the second, the operation depends almost entirely upon the element spirits. To this species belongs the binding by words, of animals especially, in order that they do no damage, also the conjuring for the sick. To the second division belongs solicitation from the element spirits for rain, cold, etc. To obtain the end required, the object for which the solicitation is offered, whether a newly born child, freshly sown seed, or newly grafted tree, must be placed en rapport with the spirits of nature. And this is to be done by certain ceremonies. To call forth magical influence, peculiarities in food, dress, and demeanor must be observed. Armlets of metal bearing the names of angels must also be worn. Then, with the entire strength of his will, must the magician offering his sacrifices, especially incense, call upon the name of the spirits, the mixture of various metals increasing the influence. This so-called soothsaying widely differs from black magic, although it cannot be denied that natural magic borders upon the world of night, since through worship of nature, it more and more removes man from worship of the divinity. The worship of nature among the heathens, so long as it does not become dark and satanic, being simply a materialized worship of the supreme, does not prevent revelations reaching them from a higher world. The Kabbalah teaches that the heathen receive revelations and true dreams. It even maintains that, in general, the heathen are as capable as receiving the Holy Spirit as the Israelites. All depends upon the hearts and actions of men. According to the teaching of the Kabbalah, the heathen were not absolutely cast off by God, but rather conducted by him unto these frontiers of nature. As we read in the words of Moses, when the Most High divided to the nations their inheritance, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the bounds of the people according to the number of the children of Israel. Deuteronomy 32:8. Unless thou lift up thine eyes unto heaven, and when thou seest the sun, and the moon, and the stars, even all the host of heaven, shouldest be driven to worship them and serve them, which the Lord thy God hath divided into all nations under the whole heaven. Molitor adds that severe as is the Jewish law against the heathen, Its severity is directed not against the heathen who worship God under the form of the powers of nature, but against such as even without better knowledge have devoted themselves to diabolical services and to the black art connected with it. And severer still was the law against the Israelites, who, as the chosen people, redeemed from the bondage of external nature, should fall back again into their blindness. It was even forbidden to the Israelites to plant trees around their temple, because, according to Maimonides, trees attract the astral influences and thus might lead to false exaltation. The Kabbalah also teaches much regarding physical uncleanness, tuma, which it maintains to be a consequence of the fall. Tuma is divided into two principal classes. There is coarse uncleanness, which is an abomination before God, and yet a subtler one which causes a dimness in the soul. The nearer that man approaches sacred things, the more lively becomes his sensibility to this dimness, as may be seen in the instance of the priests. With external things, it is also the same. The more closely man assimilates himself to them, the more susceptible he becomes for the tumah. Those organic things which come most into contact with his physical frame are more liable to become unclean than objects which are more remote and have less affinity with him. The human corpse, according to this law, is far more unclean than the dead bodies of beasts. Man being the most highly organized creature, in his decay, the most revolting decay takes place. The later Talmudists, therefore, declare that a far higher degree of uncleanness exists in the corpses of holy men than in the corpses of unholy. Still more important conclusions may be drawn from the spiritual tumah. Sin, says the Kabbalah, causes not alone imperfection in the image of man formed after the divine image, but extends itself throughout nature and even ascends into the region of angels and to the divine presence. Thus is the Shekinah violated, Plato's divine ideal world, Jebom Sophia, and transformed into gloom and severity. The divinity turns aside his countenance from such of his children as are unadorned with good works. The divine influence reaches them but rarely, and they must be punished by severe suffering. This causes sorrow and suffering even to the divinity, as was already prophesied of the Messiahs, who, in order gradually to reanimate the fallen, let his light shine in the darkness and raised up men even against their wills and prepared them for inward freedom. But in no sudden or violent manner. Through sin, man not alone has caused suffering to the divinity, but throughout the universe, especially in this our world, Asaya, where nature has become full of dissonances, and all creation sighs beneath the curse of Adam's sin. Man, returning in penitence, God, together with the guardian angels, is ever ready to aid him in the contest with sin. And in the same degree that man desires goodness does he attract God's influence. And the darkness is changed into light, and severity into mercy. Idolatry, murder, and immortality are the three chief divisions of moral uncleanness. Those unnatural unions which are spoken of in the Old Testament are to be regarded as belonging to this species of uncleanness. Seething the kid in its mother's milk, the yoking together, the ox and the ass, the planting near to each other of trees of adverse natures. The Kabbalah observes, with reference to forbidden marriages between near of kin, that in such unions an unnatural evolution takes place, the branches being, as it were, bent backwards towards the root instead of spreading widely from the tree. Speaking of the contagious power of evil, the Kabbalah says, as physical disease streams forth from men, so does the uncleanness of the soul ever magically stream forth, possessing a power of contamination, not alone for men, but for external things. From this proceeds the repulsion felt by the pure in the presence of the wicked. A repulsion, the more keenly experienced, the higher is the purity. Each evil deed, each impure word, is thus possessed of a magical existence which renders unclean all around it. In a land where great crime is rife, all things, houses, furniture, beasts, plants, the very earth and air are corrupted. Thus, when a city gives itself up to idolatry, Must it be utterly destroyed with fire and sword, man and beast, and never more be rebuilt? Equally strong with the laws against Tuma are the laws against magic. According to the Bible, the Talmud and the Kabbalah magic is divided into three classes. The first as an abomination to be punished, like idolatry, with death. The second with scourging. And for the third, no punishment is ordained, but it is pronounced wrong as leading from the reliance upon God. The first class includes all evil enchantments and magical cures, the citation of evil spirits, and the calling forth the dead through the aid of demons. The invoker of the dead is alone condemned to death, the questioner of the dead to scourging. According to Moses, it is simply forbidden to practice magic, not to be acquainted with the art or to study it, since the members of the Sanhedrin, Molitor, page 328, must have been acquainted with magic before being able to pass judgment upon it. The second class includes that magic which is produced through the agency of the lower and evil spirits of nature, by which means man is often led astray and sunk into eternal darkness. The third class, although not so strictly forbidden, is nevertheless pronounced unfit for the pious Israelites. And this is astrology. According to the Talmud and Kabbalah, the stars have as great an influence upon man as upon the whole of nature. For the constellations presiding at the birth of a child determine its physical and mental qualities. Intercourse with the so-called spirits of nature belongs also to this class. And these spirits were all designated Shadim, a name also borne by evil demons. But these spirits must not be confounded with satanic beings. These extracts from Molitor's writings are sufficient to give the contents of the Kabbalah with regard to magic, which it treats of in all its ramifications, containing that which became Christian mysticism and the magic of the Middle Ages. Also, it contains much regarding what we now designate animal magnetism. In conclusion, I give from Molitor's appendix a story regarding a Jewess who was possessed by an evil spirit. In the time of Lariah, there was a widow, into whom a ruach, spirit, had entered, and to whom he had occasioned much distress. People went to her and received answers from her to the questions which they asked. The relatives of the woman went to Lariah and besought him to drive forth the spirit from the woman. Lariah dispatched his scholar, R. Chaim Vital, giving him certain holy names by which to cast forth the spirit, and instructing him what he should do. Also he commanded him to speak Nidwi and Cherim, the lesser and greater ban, and to drive forth the Ruach with violence. When R. Chaim came to the woman, she turned away her face. R. Chaim asked, "Wherefore dost thou turn away?" The Ruach gave answer, "I cannot look thee in the face." Then commanded Archaim that he should turn around. Vital demanded who he was, and the spirit related his evil life, declaring that he had been a Jew, had wandered 25 years through the earth, and was pursued by 3 angels of destruction. Vital demanded who had given him permission to enter into the woman. The Ruach answered, "I was in the house when the woman arose and was about to kindle the fire. The tinder would not catch, and she became angry, and in rage flung the flint and steel out of her hands, crying, 'Go to Satan.' This word Satan gave me permission to enter into her." Although the woman had sinned in unbelief and did not believe in the flight into Egypt, still the Ruach had no power over her until in her anger she pronounced the name of Satan. Thank you for listening to this sample. To continue listening to this book and for access to all of our other full audiobooks, please subscribe for $7.77 per month. Go to adultbrain.ca or follow the link in the show notes. This will be a completely separate podcast with a new RSS feed and will have all the titles from this feed as well. Thank you for your help and support in bringing rare and forgotten books to audio for the world.